This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi there, I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk about difficulties getting help for opioid addiction.
And a lot of people who we've seen, they want help. They don't want to be addicted to this drug.
Then an interview with the author of American Islamophobia.
State-sponsored structural Islamophobia intensifies, emboldens, abets the private Islamophobia we see on the ground.
MLive reporter Paula Gardner on the cost of dealing with PFAS.
Suddenly we realize that PFAS is a problem. It's considered hazardous by the state of Michigan for landfill purposes, and so the costs are just skyrocketing.
We talk with our political commentators about a gas tax for fixing the roads.
Everybody talks about, well, the voters are frustrated, the drivers are frustrated, they're hitting potholes, they're cracking windshields. Boy, they must be so mad to be willing to pay anything. False. They're not.
All of that, and we've got an artisan of Michigan for you today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan ranks 13th in opioid deaths in the nation. Many of these deaths are in rural areas where certified addiction specialists are rare. Joining us is Audrey Smith with the Family Medical Center of Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We keep hearing about this opioid crisis, and for some people in the audience, I'm sure they've had a personal experience with a friend or a loved one. The Michigan healthcare community writ large has been working on this crisis for a while now, and it only seems to be getting worse. Why?
Well, getting worse is all relative. The number of opioid deaths has been increasing. And I'd say probably in the last year, you have seen some things begin to plateau, in part because now they're starting to have more providers who waiver to provide Suboxone as well as Vivitrol.
And these are drugs to use to help people get off opioids?
Yes. They are called medication-assisted treatment. Suboxone is a drug that helps someone who's addicted to opioids begin to titrate down and then get off. And then Vivitrol will help someone not even experience the high.
I saw a 2017 University of Michigan study found 40% of suicides in the state are linked to opioid use. What's the connection there?
The relation between suicide and then unintentionally overdosing, it's a fine line. You can overdose by a couple of reasons. One, you're on a benzodiazepine. That's a type of mood stimulator, if you will, and then also be taking your heroin or some other opioid type drug. Those are counterindicated and someone can unintentionally die. The categorization of it as an unintentional death versus a suicide really comes through when you look into the history of the individual.
Let's talk about the healthcare folks. You were saying that we're seeing more physicians who are being certified to treat addiction, but there still are not nearly enough to meet the demand, especially in rural areas. How's that problem being dealt with?
Michigan has provided the community mental health authorities within a variety of rural communities with extra funds to help increase the amount of prescribers, as well as to increase education and help smooth any particular barriers where persons may have getting to a provider who would prescribe. In Michigan, in 2015, we had 56 providers who were able to prescribe only up to 30 patients. In 2018, we have 393 providers. Then there's another category. After you've been waivered for a year, you can then increase the amount of patients that you care for to 100. And in 2015, we had 35. Whereas in 2018, we had 65.
I was reading that the healthcare industry basically says there are still some primary care physicians who are a little too loose with the opioid prescriptions, but knowing what we know about some of these painkillers, why would primary care physicians prescribe them at all? Aren't there alternatives, or do we have to, are these effective enough that in limited use, they're the only alternative?
Well, there certainly are alternatives, and it really is based on the provider's understanding of their patient. There's alternatives such as therapy, and not just substance use therapy, but occupational therapy. And there are lower drugs that can deal with pain, if you will, because the biggest issue that gets one to dealing with an opioid is pain. In addition to that, the MAPS, the Michigan Automated Prescription System, is now a requirement. It's a computer system.
And that basically says a person couldn't go from doctor to doctor without being recorded and the state recognizing it.
The MAPS system allows that provider to see if a patient is drug seeking or even if they've been prescribed some other type of medication that would contraindicate with the opioid. And that, I believe, is really helping to curb this issue of primary care providers prescribing opioids without thinking twice about it.
If someone is addicted and seeks help, how likely is that person going to get help quickly?
That, too, can be a challenge, especially in rural communities, given that if you're looking at the drug Suboxone, there's a limit on the number of patients a provider can prescribe. There is sometimes where they either have to wait if they're trying to get care in their community, or they may have to go to another community. In Monroe and Lenawee County, there was like one prescriber, and there were several patients having to go to Wayne County or having to go to Jackson to receive care. And now in these particular communities, there are now at least 7 prescribers. And so we're able to certainly care for those patients versus having to go, you know, miles and miles away. So it's getting better.
Let's bottom line this. Are we making significant headway at all in dealing with the opioid crisis in Michigan?
We are making incremental headway. And I believe in part the awareness is key to everyone in the community, just not the prescriber or the patient, but their family, and seeing that someone who's taking these type of drugs, Vicodin, Narco, oxycodone, all those medications, that there is help for them. And a lot of people who we've seen, they want help. They don't want to be addicted to this drug. The other part of it is then having folks that can treat. And so strengthening the provider's practice, having community support is really important. That type of thing has to happen in all communities, especially in rural communities, because they are so geographically spread.
We've been talking about the opioid crisis in Michigan and how there have been incremental improvements with Audrey Smith. She is the COO of Family Medical Center of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
By the way, the Centers for Disease Control released new data this week showing men die of opioid overdoses nearly 3 times more than women. And death by opioid overdose is also increasing faster in African-American and Latino populations than among whites. Last year, nearly 3,000 people died in Michigan from drug overdoses. That's an 80% increase in the last 5 years. There's a form of treatment, as we just heard, that could help. It involves prescription medication to fight addiction and has been called the gold standard for opioid treatment. But it can be hard to find in northern Michigan. Interlock and Public Radio's Max Johnson has that story.
Mike Lober was addicted to painkillers and heroin for 40 years. He says for most of his life, he was constantly chasing his next fix.
We just call it chasing the dragon.
Mike tried to quit drugs almost 20 times, but it never stuck. Eventually, he found a doctor that prescribed him a medication called Zubsolve. It suppressed his opioid cravings and withdrawals. But there was one problem. The doctor was almost 3 hours away in Alpena. Every month, Mike took a cab to the clinic. He was paying about $500 for the drive and another $250 for the visit fee.
But, you know, I really jumped at the opportunity because I had to do something.
Mike drove to Alpena because he couldn't find a doctor closer to him in Traverse City. And he wasn't alone. People across northern Michigan drive hours to get this treatment. Dr. William Maroney treats people in recovery. Every day, he meets patients from northern Michigan in places like Bay City, Midland, and Mount Pleasant. He says some of his patients drive 3 or 4 hours just to see him. Maroney himself spends a few hours driving from clinic to clinic. He's already on the road when I call him at 9 a.m.
Where are you right now, actually?
I have a commission meeting for impaired driving in Diamonddale, south of Lansing. How do I sound?
Maroney says he sees up to 100 patients each year from northern Michigan alone because there aren't providers nearby. He says this treatment, sometimes called medication-assisted treatment, is effective, but offering it can be difficult. For starters, doctors need to get a waiver from law enforcement. They may also need a license for behavioral health treatment and certification for addiction counseling. Maroney says the prep work ends up scaring off a lot of doctors.
A license to treat, a license for me personally to be a treatment program, to handle the different drugs if they need disposal. The regulation keeps people from going into this.
Doctors can also have a hard time getting paid. Medication-assisted treatment is covered by Medicaid and private insurers, but in some cases, only for a year. If treatment lasts longer than that, which is relatively common, patients have a decision to make: pay out of pocket or try something else.
I mean, I got people that I see that I haven't been able to bill on for months, maybe for an entire year. Well, you can't turn them away, you know? So there's all sorts of ways to lose money in this.
Maroney accepts cash for treatment. He says that's the only way a lot of his patients can pay for it. But that got him investigated by the Michigan Attorney General's office. Law enforcement has an eye out for so-called pill mills, practices that overprescribe medication to make money. They found no wrongdoing in Maroney's practice, but he says that stigma around this treatment is just another reason doctors stay away from it. On top of all that, Maroney says some doctors don't want these patients in their lobby.
Because you treat these people, moms coming in with baby checks are going to say, I don't really know that I want to be here anymore, and you lose patients.
Because of all this, there aren't a lot of treatment providers in northern Michigan. There has been some progress in Traverse City. Addiction Treatment Services opened a clinic in August, but it wasn't easy. Chris Heinbaugh is their CEO. He says it was hard to find a doctor.
There just weren't any practitioners. So in the end, we found somebody that had lots of experience in the emergency room. But then, yes, ask her to get waivered, to take the courses, to train the rest of the staff, and to build a clinic.
It took Addiction Treatment Services 3 years and $250,000 to offer medication-assisted treatment. Then, within a month, their caseload was full. They're allowed to take more patients after a year. In the meantime, Munson Medical Center and Traverse Health Clinic started offering medication-assisted treatment last year. Supporters say the state could make it more available by easing up on license requirements and removing patient caps, but there's no sign any of that's going to happen. As of 2016, there were over 32,000 people in Michigan seeking treatment for opioid addiction. For Stateside, I'm Max Johnston.
Coming up, we talk with the author of the book, America Islamophobia. He says when government leaders target Muslims, people on the ground take that as a cue that it's okay to discriminate. Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The murder of 50 Muslim worshipers in Christchurch, New Zealand, has ignited an international conversation about Islamophobia. One Australian lawmaker even blamed Muslim immigrants for the attack by a white nationalist. I recently spoke with Khalid Baydoun, a law professor and a Detroiter who teaches on the intersection of constitutional law, race, and religion at the University of Arkansas. His new book is American Islamophobia: Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. I asked him about the history behind Islamophobia in the Western world. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a lot to unpack in the book. Let's get right to it. Let's start with a couple of definitions. Explain to us what private Islamophobia is, what's structural Islamophobia, and how do they feed into each other?
Private Islamophobia is pretty much the fear, hatred, animus that is coming from private individuals, citizens, individuals who might be your neighbors, classmates, your colleagues at work, effectively, indirectly, not tied to the state. These are individuals who are acting on their own merit. Structural Islamophobia, on the other hand, is the form of Islamophobia that is coming from the state itself by way of state-sponsored policy, law, presidential rhetoric, the rhetoric of senators, congressmen, and so forth. So there's a distinction there. It's an important distinction, but there's also a convergence where state-sponsored or structural Islamophobia intensifies, emboldens, abets the private Islamophobia we see on the ground.
Law enforcement and government officials would say, look, we didn't make that guy go down there with a rifle. We didn't make that guy who followed a woman into the Kroger grocery store in Dearborn and start hassling and shoving and abusing her. So why would you say that they feed into each other like that?
Well, it's not direct causation. It's not that there's a explicit dictate coming from the state that's actually mandating that individuals go and attack Muslims or individuals who look Muslim. But there is a relationship there, right? If the law is effectively based on the presumption that Muslim identity is presumptive or tied to terrorism, it is communicating something specific to private citizens.
Who was Edward Said, and why is he important to understanding Islamophobia in the United States?
Edward Said is, in my opinion, one of the most important American intellectuals. He is somebody who closely studied how Islam is, you know, examined, is portrayed in the media, intellectual spaces. Wrote a really important book in 1979 called Orientalism. And the thesis behind Orientalism was that the West effectively defines itself in mirror opposite terms of the Orient. And the Orient here is synonymous with the Muslim world. So by virtue of this dialectic, this theory, if you will, we have these foundational baselines that give rise to modern Islamophobia. So, for instance, Orientalism holds that the Muslim world is backwards, it's static, it's always wet to war, it's savage, and so on and so forth. And through the embedment of these stereotypes, we see the production or reproduction of them through Islamophobia today.
Basically, they're our mirror opposite, where during the Cold War, we had another enemy, the communists, the Soviet Union. Now we lost that enemy, and we had to come up with a new enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So why did that fit so well into that narrative?
You know, Samuel Huntington, who I'm critical of in the book, has a poignant quote in one of his books. I think it's A Clash of Civilizations, where he writes, "In order to know ourselves, we have to know who our enemy is." That sort of like sets forth this geopolitical paradigm where the United States and most empires need a definitive rival in order to effectively define who they are. So after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, there was a void there. There was a void in terms of, you know, finding an empire, a civilization, a nation that we could effectively pit ourselves against. Islam and the monolithic Muslim world effectively filled that void, you know, after the walls came crumbling down in the Soviet Union.
You know, with the Iranian hostage situation in 79, the news media, a lot of people in the government, and even Hollywood quickly identified that new enemy. So tell us how that happened.
It didn't begin with the fall of the Soviet Union. It was always there. You know, in my academic research, I closely examine the 18th century and how Islam was effectively interpreted and portrayed by American courts. Again, through this system of Orientalism, there's always been this, at worst, demonization of Islam and Muslims, and at best, this idea that Muslims were this, you know, foreign class of people that could not be assimilated into the American, body politic or American society. What happens, though, is this proliferation of this representation and idea with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, then obviously it becomes prolific during the War on Terror.
In 1995, a federal building in Oklahoma City was blown up, 168 people killed, another 680 people injured. What were some of the news media's immediate responses?
I recall just flipping through the news. You know, back then you didn't go to social media. You went to the television to watch the news. You know, people like Connie Chung, Tom Brokaw, within a matter of minutes, you know, effectively making a pretty confident assessment that the culprits were Muslims, you know, saying things that this had the signature, the fingerprints of Muslim Middle Eastern terrorism and so on, without any modicum of evidence. They just rushed to it based on, some sort of innate feeling or the power of stereotype. They were all proven wrong a couple of hours later.
Right, because it ended up being white domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh and, of course, Terry Nichols from Michigan. Well, there's been this historic Islamophobia. How did things change for Muslims in America after the 9/11 attacks in 2001?
Yeah, so that was a watershed moment that effectively, you know, implements the modern structural Islamophobic state. With 9/11, again, the culprits were largely Saudis, Wahhabi Muslims, a specific sliver of the broader global Muslim population. However, what happens is because people have a, you know, monolithic understanding of Muslims, they just categorically blamed all Muslims. As a consequence of that, we see, you know, in rapid time, policies like the Patriot Act, policies like NSEER's National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, which is effectively the Muslim Registry before Trump calls it the Muslim Registry, which was in place for 9 years. So the state, through the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security, adopts a really robust, aggressive, and in my opinion, bigoted disposition towards Muslims in this country.
One of the things that's been interesting is it's not just Muslims who've been targeted. Yeah. Sikhs have been targeted because they somehow match the we'll use the word ignorant person's idea of what a Muslim looks like. Mm-hmm. Christian Arabs have been attacked as well. This Islamophobic behavior seems indiscriminate. How do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point because it really distinguishes private Islamophobia from structural Islamophobia. And I think that's why we have to be careful with, you know, severing the two. So private Islamophobes typically can't tell the difference between a bona fide, legitimate Muslim and an individual, like you said, who kind of fits within the stereotypical caricature of who they think Muslims are. Sikh men, like you've stated, are oftentimes the primary victims of Islamophobia. However, the state knows who Muslims are. Structural Islamophobia and various state agencies specifically know who Muslims are in terms of race, ethnicity, sectarian belief, whether Sunni or Shia, class, and so on and so forth. But private Islamophobia is, again, driven by this racialized idea that Muslims look a certain way. And as a consequence of that, you have a whole range of non-Muslims who are targeted and vulnerable to Islamophobia.
In the wake of 9/11, how well did George W. Bush and his administration delineate between terrorists and Muslims as a whole?
There was a conflation, and this conflation with terrorism and Islam and Muslim identity drove the war on terror forward. So it was really callous. It was, in my opinion, strategic looking back. So I thought he did a terrible job. It was driven by bigotry because the idea was, and again, this underlies the war on terror, is that Muslim identity, any manifestation of Muslim identity, is presumptive of the possibility of terrorism. So, for instance, the more conservative one looked in terms of how they appeared as Muslims, the more they practiced the religion, the more they were critical in terms of their speech or positions towards American domestic or foreign policy, the more frequent they went home to their native homelands. I'm Egyptian, so the more I went back home to Egypt, that might raise red flag that I might be engaged in terrorism. So it was a bigoted policy, whereas maximizing your Muslim identity increases the prospect of you being policed or deemed suspicious by the state.
You're quite critical of Barack Obama in the book. And this is a man who started his presidency by addressing Muslims in Cairo, saying he was seeking a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. In what ways do you feel he failed the Muslim American community?
It's tough to say. So a lot of this stuff is comparative assessment in terms of one presidential administration to the next. I would say the Obama administration was, in some respects, better and I think more sensitive to the conditions of Muslim Americans than the Bush administration. Clearly a better administration than the one we have in office right now. But yeah, Obama spearheads his administration by giving this really important speech in Cairo, where effectively the idea was it was his objective and his administration's objective to mend the wounds of the war on terror. That was effectively the message behind his speech in Cairo. But what becomes discouraging and where things decline after that speech is a couple of things. First, in 2011, Obama enacts what I consider to be the most pernicious, nefarious form of structural Islamophobia, which is counter-radicalization policing. You know, and second, you know, President Obama was destructive in the kind of foreign policy engaged in and some of the tactics. Drone attacks in Yemen, for instance, which is currently being ravaged by attacks by Saudi Arabia, increased in high measure under the Obama administration.
During the Donald Trump campaign and during his presidency, you write he's blurred the distinction between Muslims and terrorists. In what ways?
In a range of ways. Presidential rhetoric specifically, we could see during the campaign that, and it was strategic. You know, Trump knew that by effectively disavowing dog whistle politics and embracing explicit sort of appeals at Islamophobia, that would galvanize a base. So when he says on December 7th that it was his objective to propose or institute a Muslim ban, he's doing something very specific. When he says to Anderson Cooper 6 months before being elected that Islam hates us, he's doing something very specific. He's appealing directly to this whole clash of civilizations idea that Samuel Huntington writes about in his book.
So given what we've learned from this book, I want to ask a question that's probably the hardest question you're going to get. What will it take to deal with Islamophobia in America?
A number of things. So, you know, in Michigan, for instance, what's happened in the last couple of months has been really encouraging, in my opinion. There's been a Muslim lash, if you will, to the Trump administration, evident through the increasing number of Muslim American politicians running for office. So I think that, you know, that is a manifestation of what needs to happen in order to diminish Islamophobia, but also dismantle Islamophobia. It's really vital. It's really important that we have Muslims in these halls of power to counter what Trump's saying, not relying on third parties or other individuals to speak on our behalf, but actually having representatives in the very halls of power is critical. Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, but also politicians and candidates who fell short. The campaign of Abdullah Sayyid, for instance, I view as a resounding victory, right? Because what it does is it demonstrates that Muslims can't compete for the highest offices in this country during a moment of intense Islamophobia. That's an important message that we send not only to the Muslim community, but also broadly in America.
The book is American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. The author is Khalid Baydoun. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Every once in a while, I get to go out into this great state and talk to artisans. The most recent trip was to Marshall, Michigan. In this nondescript building, Derek Smith is reaming a hole to fit a tuning key into a head of a mandolin. That sound is a little irritating, so I asked Smith if he could create a different sound. Smith and the rest of the team at Northfield Mandolins make high-end instruments, and the demand for mandolins is brisk.
It amazes me with all instruments, because I've worked with instruments for over 20 years, if not here. I worked with elderly instruments, is where I started years ago. And I wondered all the time, and still do, where do all these instruments go? Because we're not the only ones, and we're pretty tiny compared to some of the larger manufacturers. So apparently there is a large demand, and there's some very noteworthy people, Chris Thiele on the scene now with his radio show. I mean, I have to imagine that's giving the mandolin a good boost. It's good for us.
Hi, it's Chris Thiele inviting you to tune into our show live from here each weekend, where you'll hear some amazing music, a bit of comedy, and my new song of the week.
Thiele plays the mandolin on Live From Here, which airs on nearly 600 public radio stations across the nation. As we walked around the shop, Smith was showing me some of the mandolins being made.
We build, I guess offhand, probably 8 or 9 different models of mandolins, all mandolin. Sometimes standard bodies, sometimes octave mandolins.
Yeah, you were showing me that. It looks like a guitar.
Yeah, very much a guitar, traditional guitar body. We've made it significantly smaller than what most people see in guitars, but the flat top bracing nature is all there. But still has 8 strings like a mandolin, tuned like a mandolin, but an octave lower.
Northfield also has a shop in China, in Qingdao. The two shops work cooperatively and ship parts and instruments back and forth. Some of the mandolins made in Marshall get shipped to Qingdao, and some of the Chinese mandolins are shipped to the U.S. I was curious, who was buying these higher-priced mandolins?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, most of them are probably residing in the States, but we ship many mandolins internationally as well. I mean, we have dealers, several in Europe, one in Japan. We ship to Australia. We ship all over Canada. So in terms of where people are buying it, it's everywhere. There's definitely that strong bluegrass person that's buying our mandolins, but it's finding its way into Celtic music, pop music. I mean, there's really the boundaries these days are really blurred.
One of the things you can't help but notice in the shop are humidifiers scattered all around. Smith says keeping a little humidity in the air helps the instruments and wood. He was actually working on a mandolin one customer sent in to be repaired. It had been severely dried out.
On the back, you could literally see there's braces that run inside here, and there's a big neck block. You could see the maple sucked in around those things. It was so, I'm amazed it didn't crack. I'm very pleased it didn't crack.
Tell me, what do you like? What fascinates you about being involved in this process of making mandolins or any instrument for that matter?
Oh, man, you know, I think at the root of it, I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, because I was kind of thinking about, okay, you know, well, how's this interview going to go? But what I was thinking of yesterday, what really draws me to the process, because I touch every part of the mandolin manufacturing process from going and looking at the tree to shipping it out the door and really everything in between. And I think when I really find the ultimate pleasure or sort of loss of myself in this work, it's when I'm doing something very simple, usually machining wood before it's ever a mandolin, usually processing a tree into boards. And I feel like, I literally feel like I'm part of something that's been done for a very long time. It's almost like an ancestral line, if that's not getting too deep with it. Well, it's not for me. When I'm sitting there working on a piece of wood, it's like, this feels probably pretty much like it did 5,000 years ago, working on a piece of wood. And for me, that's totally cool, man. I really, when I feel that in my bones and I'm working on a piece of wood, it's like, yep, that's it.
That's Derek Smith with Northfield Mandolins in Marshall, our latest artisan of Michigan. Oh, one more thing. The folks at Northfield have been organizing an annual Marshall Mandolin Summit. It brings in players, teachers, and students from all over, and many performances are open to the public. This year, it will be held August 8th through the 11th. Support for arts and culture coverage is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Up next, how communities across the state are dealing with the cost of PFAS contamination.
It's tens of millions of dollars to run new water lines that will serve a significant number of people. And it costs millions of dollars even to just study that.
Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been hearing about PFAS contamination in groundwater and surface water in spots across the state. It's contaminated private wells. It's gotten into water used for communities' drinking water. And even wastewater treatment plants are dealing with it. That all means a lot of changes and a lot of money. MLive published a piece this week looking at a lot of those costs. Paula Gardner is the reporter, and she joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester.
So water treatment plants, the ones who clean up the water we drink, they're having to add processes to reduce the amount of PFAS in the water. What kind of cost are communities facing when they do that?
Every community is facing different types of charges, and depending on what type of filter they already use, they're either upgrading and changing or having to consider entirely new equipment. So in a place like Ann Arbor, they change their carbon filters at a cost of about $1 million. In a place like Plainfield Township, that cost multiple millions of dollars, and they're looking at adding new water lines, and they're looking at possibly $60 million in changes over time.
Yeah, you know, when you say carbon filters, I think people get in mind a little canister, but I was out at the water plant, the Ann Arbor water plant, not too long ago, and we're talking about like almost like small swimming pools, and there are like 28 of them in the facility there. So we're not talking about a little carbon filter. That's why it costs $1 million. You've got all this extensive acreage that you've got to cover just to get enough water clean enough. In some areas, such as Parchment, the water plant just simply could not deal with the high levels of PFAS. The town had to switch water to another community. That's happened in Oscoda Township, and it might be the case in Plainville Township. What kind of costs are we talking about there when you're running new water lines big enough to serve a city or a whole township?
It's tens of millions of dollars to run new water lines that will serve a significant number of people. And it costs millions of dollars even to just study that. So in Muskegon this week, they're looking at $100,000 towards studying how to remedy some of the water issues that are emerging there near the airport. But ultimately, the studies alone could cost them $4 million.
Now, I want to talk about not drinking water, but wastewater treatment plants, because they're finding high levels of PFAS in their effluent that goes into the rivers and streams. What are they going to have to do?
That's a really interesting question. So a lot of what they need to do is control what's coming into their plant. So that pushes back onto the polluter. And that's such a gray area for Michigan right now. We just haven't seen a lot of enforcement that actually asks for costs to the municipality. So they're asking the polluter actually to stop polluting, which is a reasonable request, but then they have to go through a number of changes, a number of equipment upgrades.
And a couple of plants in the state have done that.
They have done that. But then the wastewater treatment plants also are left with the chemicals are in their systems too, and they don't know how to get them out. And that's a problem that they've never had to confront. So I haven't been able to find one yet that's actually cleaned out their own equipment, but they're talking possibly millions to deal with that, possibly new lines. And then also, they're storing sludge on site. So anytime that they had a high level of PFAS coming through their system, it left in the water and went into the surface water, but some of it also stayed in the sludge. And historically, they've either shipped that away to a landfill or they've land applied it through biosolids. So there's a problem there too.
And when you say land apply, you mean on farm fields, and therefore there's PFAS on farm fields in some places around the state, which is also a big concern. I don't know how we'll ever deal with that since these are forever chemicals. That sludge, I understand one town is now hauling that sludge to a hazardous waste landfill, and the price you cited in your story was, I thought it was astronomical for just hauling it to a hazardous waste facility. What kind of money are we talking about?
So Ionia is spending over $400,000 this year to move their sludge to the only hazardous waste landfill in Michigan that will accept it. So previously, when they were moving the sludge to a landfill, it wasn't classified as hazardous unless there were other chemicals in it. Suddenly, we realized that PFAS is a problem. It's considered hazardous by the state of Michigan for landfill purposes. And so the costs are just skyrocketing.
Even testing for PFAS is expensive. You cited one Wayne County wastewater employee who asked the DEQ, do you still want us to sample these 11 industries? It's so expensive because the testing was like hundreds of dollars each time.
Yeah, so it's $300 or $400. And in retrospect, you kind of want to laugh at it. Like, don't you want to know how much PFAS is coming from these chemicals? But on the other side of it, we've got our municipalities really feeling stretched
already. That guy's got a budget, right? He's got to stay under budget.
Exactly.
So these costs are surprises to counties, townships, cities, even schools. What are they doing when faced with hundreds of thousands, millions, or even tens of millions of dollars in unexpected costs?
It depends on the municipality, but so far, they're basically making their ratepayers or taxpayers pay for it. So they're absorbing it into their existing funds. They're looking forward and hoping to recover from a polluter. They're hoping that the DEQ will come through with a grant. And then they're just looking to their general fund budget to kind of make it work in the short term.
In the short term, though, that's a hit. And I'm just keep thinking, why should these communities, these school districts, have to pay these costs at all? They didn't pollute the water. There's something not just in that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question for Michigan. And I was surprised that that we're not really dealing with it on a higher level yet. Every time I called the municipality, like, they were dealing with it on their own. The state isn't taking an active role in kind of pulling it in as an umbrella issue yet. And neither are places like the Michigan Townships Association or the Michigan Municipal League. It's just not rising yet as an issue that people want to solve on a larger basis.
Is the legal community looking at this and trying to figure out some solutions for these municipalities?
I would hope so. That's not something I had a lot of success with either. So in the case of Plainfield Township, there is a lawsuit, and the state of Michigan initiated it, and a couple of townships have joined in, including Plainfield and a neighboring township. So there is some hope that in the case of something that seems like a very clear-cut situation, that there will be some financial assistance from the polluter.
So the Attorney General's office, yes, is aware and working on it.
Yes.
Okay. So what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is that Michigan needs to spend a lot more time thinking about how it's treating its water. And that means its surface water and its groundwater and ultimately the drinking water for Michigan residents. And the reporting that I did on this issue, and we have sidebars and additional reporting that contributed to it by Garrett Ellison, my colleague at MLive, who's been covering PFAS. We collaborated with Detroit Public Television and the Great Lakes Now initiative to try to tell these stories, and I think elevate it into the community, and hopefully people will pay more attention and that we'll be able to answer some of these questions in the future.
Paula Gardner is a reporter for MLive. Her report this week is titled PFAS Pollution Already Costing Michigan Communities Millions of Dollars. I just want to say personally, thank you and your colleague Garrett Ellison for doing a really fine job covering this PFAS issue for a long time. It's been consistently good work.
Oh, thank you. We appreciate it.
Where is the state of Michigan going to find the money to fix the roads? That seems to be the top question in Lansing these days. Joining us are our political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. And John Selleck is CEO of Lansing public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He was communications director for two Republican attorneys general and worked in a Michigan governor's office and the legislature. All right, let's start with a simple question. Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer has proposed an additional 45 cents a gallon gas tax. What is the likelihood of that actually happening? Vicki?
Well, we've talked about this before. I think the actual likelihood of that happening is probably really close to zero. There's no appetite on the part of Senate Majority Leader Shirky to do any kind of tax increases and just use existing money to try to shuffle it around to take care of road funding. I think that's where the problem lies right now. There's a wall dividing them between new revenue and using existing revenue.
John, how likely will we see a 45 cent a gallon gas tax increase?
We won't see a 45 cent increase, but this issue is kind of unique in that everybody talks about, well, the voters are frustrated, the drivers are frustrated, they're hitting potholes, they're cracking windshields. Boy, they must be so mad they'd be willing to pay anything. False. They're not. And it puts the governor, the legislators, everybody in a very tough spot. And so this is going to be a process. I do believe we're going to get to some kind of revenue increase on the roads. I just don't know what it looks like yet.
Well, let's talk about some of the options that are being talked about. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky says he's disappointed in the lack of creativity in the governor's proposal to find money for roads. But he does accept the challenge to find an additional $1.4 billion to add to the recent $1.2 billion increase in funding by a previous legislature. But maybe this item should be separate from the budget. Let's take care of the budget and then talk about road funding. Vicki, what do you think that signals?
Well, that signals that you're not really serious about finding road money for next season's construction year. And that's going to be very problematic and very frustrating for drivers. I think drivers are willing to pay something to increase funding for roads. And that's been evidenced by local road millages across the state passing. The question is, how are we going to do this at the state level when you have a Senate majority leader that doesn't want to increase taxes, a Speaker of the House that doesn't want to increase taxes, and everybody's kind of dug in their heels. And this has been the history for the last 20 years on trying to get additional road funding.
John, what should we take from Senator Shirky's willingness to accept the challenge to find more money for roads, but tackling that after the budget?
Well, look, it's totally valid for the senator to suggest that the gas tax be looked at on its own. And here's a few reasons why. One, it would be the biggest tax increase Michigan's seen at least in a decade. And then it would be affecting drivers and voters and roads for at least a decade going forward. Most of the legislators, even the governor, won't be here in a decade. So I think it's relevant to take a good look at it. Next, it's not a simple plan. It's a complicated plan. I think the governor's team would call it a sophisticated plan. But there's really two main priorities there. One is not getting as much attention, and that's education. That was where the governor got her first big endorsement. It was with the teachers union. Her goal is to put more money into K-12 and to put more money into the roads. What her team recognizes is that she can't just float an education tax out there and expect that to pass. But there is a higher frustration level with roads. So she started there. In reality, the complicated part is that all these things are tied together. To get more money for K-12, she's taking it from higher education. To get more for higher education, she wants to take it from the roads. What that means is the gas tax is the proverbial thread on the sweater. Once you start pulling on it, it all comes apart.
Right. We should talk about that because in the House, Speaker Lee Chatfield says he wants to scrap the existing tax altogether, the gas tax altogether, because some of that tax, about $800 million a year, goes to schools instead of roads, like sales taxes do, right? He wants a new, slightly higher tax implemented, and all of that tax would be dedicated to the roads. Vicki, what do you think of that idea?
Anything that is interesting, that is new, should be looked at. And we should also revisit Proposal A and what that's done to school funding and to local governments as well. And so there is this attempt to look at the overall effect of Proposal A and school aid funding and road funding and try to come up with some better approach to directing dollars toward education and to roads. And I think it should be looked at. But time is clearly passing. And I don't take to the notion that because most legislators are going to be gone that we shouldn't look at something that is much more further reaching. And that's one of the problems with government right now. It's all way too short-sighted. short-sighted, and it doesn't account for what's going to happen 20 and 30 years from now.
John, is Speaker Chatfield onto something here?
Well, he is, and he might have some common ground with the governor. The governor says that the general fund should all be spent on things like higher education. The K-12 fund should all be spent on things like K-12. And the speaker's saying the gas tax should all be spent on roads. It's all pretty logical, and it makes sense. There are some roadblocks here that the governor's put in place for this thing to not happen, to make it tougher. She did not propose putting this new tax increase through the funding formula that exists now, which people already have frustrations with. She really set it up to be more of a rural versus urban setup because most of the money in her plan and the increase would go to the state roads. And if you look at legislative districts right now where the Republicans are sitting, they're not primarily in urban, suburban areas. They're in the rural areas. They're in the townships.
Right, a lot of county and township roads, yeah.
Right, so there's no incentive there for them to vote for this.
I was looking at a report from the free market think tank, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Here's my quick summary. It indicates no tax increase is necessary. One, additional revenue because of the growing economy will be enough. But if it's not, two, you can end corporate welfare. Three, eliminate state arts grants. Four, eliminate state support for the University of Michigan. Five, reduce funding for preschool. And six, enhancement grant spending for things such as civic centers disappears. And finally, extra money being sent to school districts to get pension funds back to sustainable levels should be eliminated. Oh, one more thing, eliminate state funding for ag bio research at Michigan State University, which is tough for an ag school, you would think. But voila, road's fixed. What do you think of that, Vicki?
Well, we seem to be stuck in this time warp in Michigan where we haven't recognized that in the last 20 years, inflation has increased 46.79% according to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. So while we had all of this money, like a $10 billion general fund in 2000, all of this growth in tax revenue has still kept our general fund at $10 billion, and we don't have enough money. We haven't accounted for inflation and growth in the cost of living and the cost of repair of our infrastructure. And so, voila, all of this money would first put our children in preschool systems last and really hurt our future generation. Two, it would cut University of Michigan and Michigan State University, which are two of the top 100 universities on the planet, and you would be destroying their reputation slowly over time by doing that and eroding our education quality. And three, you wouldn't be finding enough money here to do the jobs that you need to do in order to find money for education and fixing the roads. And fourth, and finally, while I like to look at the corporate welfare portion of this, it's certainly not a large enough number to really do the job that we need to get done, and it's not consistent over time, and we need a reliable funding source.
Well, I think the Mackinac Center would disagree. They think they have the numbers. John, is the Mackinac Center's plan something the legislature might consider?
The legislature says we need to look at the budget and figure out what our priorities are. And all the groups that are out there that put out information, there are groups on the left, groups on the right, like the Mackinac Center. They all have their role to play here. And what they're saying is, if we're going to set our priorities, here are some things that we would need to choose. And sometimes we don't like the idea of choosing. Sometimes they like to have it all. But if we have endless priorities, we'd probably have endless tax increases. So they're playing their role, and they're showing the things that would be cut. As a Spartan, I wouldn't be interested in seeing U of M get cut. You know, as a younger guy, I might have been okay with it. But U of M plays a great role, as does MSU. And I'm glad to be here on U of M Radio. But I think some other pressures that are coming up soon, Lester, are in the near term, or the spring thaw. The rapid increase of potholes and rubble is going to put pressure on everybody to do something. That's going to be the key time the governor could negotiate.
Yeah, I know the packed snow and the ice aren't filling the potholes anymore.
They're really not. And then some of the things I thought were longer-term pressures that would be coming came a whole lot faster this week. We've talked about before how in the off year of election, you get things done during the election year. Things don't get done very well. Everybody's positioning for the election. But unfortunately, the presidential election in 2020 started a few days ago in Michigan. Beto O'Rourke, Kirsten Gillibrand all came here. The governor was there campaigning with them for a Democrat president against a Republican president.
And the president will be here soon.
And the president's coming himself also. And so what will happen is right now, Michigan is part of the Midwestern battleground that people are identifying. They could eventually be challenged by a Southern battleground that's forming. But the bottom line is that leaders from the Midwest are going to start to be seen on shortlists for vice president. And I believe that Governor Whitmer will show up on those lists. And so that means the tentacles of 2020 will start interfering more and more with us trying to get things done, like fixing the roads.
That is John Selleck. He's CEO of the public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He's worked with Republican attorneys general and in the governor's office and in the legislature. Thanks for joining us this week, John.
Thank you.
Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. Thank you, Vicki.
You're welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Don't get him started on how to fix the roads. Sheesh. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Sarah Leeson, and Joy Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.